Welcome to week 8 of the spring curriculum for CSF. This is Jesus Comes to Campus. I am guest hosting this week. I am CJ, and I am here with Derek.
Hey, hey.
And we are going over John 19. But before we start going over it, if you have not taken a few minutes to go read and jump into the Word, to read the passage, and check out any sort of curriculum you need to read, go do that before we start talking. And okay, you're back. So we are 4 chapters after John 15, the Good Shepherd, our last passage. And we have jumped from John 15 to the biggest section of the whole book, probably the most important part, or one of the most important parts of the whole book, John 19.
Hey man, they're all important.
You're right. But they're all leading up to this. So why don't you tell us what is going on in John 19? And what is some context for what's happening in John 19? Help situate it for us within the broader context of the book.
Sure. So the last time I was on the podcast, way back in week 1, one of the things I mentioned was that often the Gospel of John is looked at as almost an extended passion narrative. And what I mean by that, by passion, I just mean the suffering of Jesus. And really the entire book leads up, it crescendos to this moment where Jesus is on the cross. And this time, really, it starts at John 13, where things start to ramp up when Jesus washes the feet of his disciples. And then he gives an extended time of teaching and explains a lot of things that he thinks his disciples are going to need before he leaves. And then he, part of that being the Good Shepherd, which we talked about last week. And then he gets arrested and gets taken to trial and is unfairly condemned by Pilate, and then he is, in this passage, we see the sort of end of that, and then him being put on the cross and eventually dying. So that is what we usually mean by the passion narrative, and like I said, the entire gospel you can look at as leading up to this, and we just thought this was, you know, one of the most important sections, like CJ said, and it's definitely worth reflecting on the fact that Jesus died for us.
Yeah, the crucifixion. So we've been talking about what would happen if Christ came to campus. And I do think if it were legal, and maybe even if it weren't, it wouldn't shock me at all if Christ walked onto UK and they just literally crucified him. you know, maybe out front of Willie T in the bowl or something. Wouldn't shock me at all. But that's actually not what we're going to kind of take it toward. We're going to talk about Jesus as being a different kind of preacher, that actually somehow something in this passage is going to show us something about God's character in how Jesus has come to preach the kingdom. And I think you ended up wanting to contrast this a little bit with some of the preachers we see on campus. So why don't you tell us about some of those guys and then tell us how you're fitting Christ in with this, right? What makes Christ, if he were to come to campus, maybe a little bit different?
Sure. So, you know, I'm an old guy now. I'm almost 30. But when I was in college, and I know for a fact, still happens from time to time, but there's these guys that just sort of not so affectionately known on campus as the campus preachers, who stand on the corners, on the street corners, and just sort of yell at people, yell obscenities, and are just generally pretty mean people and usually say some pretty awful things to people.
Yeah, I remember when I was a student, they would go to the free speech area, which is great. They'd be at the free speech area. I remember there was this one guy who would stand on top of a painted coffin, and when people would walk by, would just yell at them. Like, if they were overweight, he'd yell, "You're fat, and you're going to go to hell." And he just pointed at people randomly walking down the street.
No idea who they are.
No idea who they are. Would just say something about how they looked, and then tell them they're going to hell because of it. I mean, this was how he preached the gospel. You know, we'll put "preach" in quotations there, but the campus preachers. I don't know if they're still doing the same stuff they were doing when we were in school, but what they were doing when we were in school was wild.
It was wild. And I know the word, even like, the one thing that always stuck out to me is like just any girl that would walk by just yelling like "whore" at them.
Yeah.
And calling them whores, like no idea what these people's lives actually are. And they would quote the Bible, and it was generally a pretty bad look for Christians on those days. And a lot of times I remember it would just cause a scene. There would be, you know, some Christian group would inevitably go, and there'd be some kind of show off, and this other person's preaching grace, and it just would make a big scene. And so
it was usually more entertaining than class.
Yeah. I always thought it was hilarious, but well,
sad, but hilarious.
Sadly hilarious. Yeah. But so obviously this is a really extreme example of what a campus preacher is, but I also think it sort of feeds into a stereotype of what we think of preachers in general, which is that they preach at us.
So, and God too, right? By extension, I think a lot of people probably think of Jesus as standing on top of a coffin.
Absolutely. Jesus is known as a preacher, and he's called that, and he does preach. He's, you know, Sermon on the Mount, Sermon on the Plain. You might have heard of these famous sermons that Jesus gives. In fact, a lot of John, these aren't necessarily sermons, but they kind of are, him talking about being the good shepherd. So in that way, Jesus is sort of a preacher, but I think there's a really fundamental difference between Jesus and these preachers, and that fundamental difference really gets played out in John 19. Because like I said, the campus preacher, what we think of as a preacher, is someone who preaches at us, someone who tells us how to fix our lives, and they are, you know, the sort of holier than thou, above mm-hmm. you, looking down. CJ, I thought you had a really good quote on that. Quote yourself really quick.
I don't know if I'm going to quote it, but no, there's this sense in which, and this is how I always felt with the campus preachers, the reason why, and the students hate the campus preachers.
Yes.
And there's a reason for it. I even think a really justifiable reason for it. I mean, there's a lot of kind of animus towards people who are in your face with faith anyway on campus, but these people in particular, and I think it's because, especially there's something about our generations, and maybe the older generations are like this as well, but I think our generations, millennials, Gen Z, are particularly sensitive to people who talk the talk but don't walk the walk. Like hypocrisy is something that's just kind of elicits a very strong response. Yeah, and my overwhelming feeling seeing these people was always that they were basically these holier-than-thou people, and that's what they acted like. They'd stand on these coffins pretending like they were holier than you, and then they would kind of assert that holiness on you and start shaming you, when in reality, it was just patently evident from how they carried themselves that, like, they weren't. A person who pretended to be holy and then brought other people low. And that's just the exact opposite of Christ, right? I mean, Christ is the person who actually was holier than anybody, but was not asserting his holiness on the crowds. Like, he wasn't condemning them. He was being condemned by them, right? He wasn't like standing on the coffin. Mm-hmm. Instead, he was like lowering himself into the grave. And so there's just a fundamental difference between what was happening with these campus preachers and what we see happening with Christ. And it's ironic, right? The holier-than-thou person is condemning everybody else, whereas in John 19, the actual holier-than-thou person is the one being condemned.
Yeah, and I even just thought of that, even that contrast in saying that the campus preachers look down upon the people that would walk by. Christ looks down upon us, but in a very different sense, and mm. he's looking down upon us from hanging on the cross. Mm. And that really, I think, starkly contrasts what's happening in the campus preacher world, where they're yelling at you, and then you have a very different kind of preacher who is not just teaching. He is teaching, because that's important. We don't want to discount that. But he's living it, and he is himself going to the cross and willing to die for not only just the things that he's teaching, but die for the people that he's loving.
Yeah, he wasn't up there shouting at the crowds. He was actually up there having the crowds shout at him.
That's right.
He was praying for them, which is kind of crazy. It's mind-blowing.
Yeah, which makes you wonder, what would this confrontation look like if Jesus did come to campus and confront these campus preachers? It probably would look a lot different than him like rebutting their claims or yelling at them or something like this, but simply dying for them, if John 19 is any indication.
Yeah, so really stark difference. But again, so we're like kind of exploring the character of God, and I think that gets at the heart of it really well. But John 19 is this really strange chapter. And I think one of the best things you can do when you read scripture is look for patterns. So like anytime you're reading like poetry or a good book, like learning how to find some of the patterns. These patterns are put in there intentionally by the authors because they're meant to communicate something to us. So in John, we have this guy who's hanging on a cross, but it's interesting what the most repeated word in the chapter is. The concept or the word that shows up the most. So when you read John chapter 19, what was that kind of theme or idea or word that showed up the most? And why do you think John chose to make that word show up the most in the context of what's actually happening in this chapter?
Sure. So, I think if you read the passage carefully, it almost just like slaps you in the face. You almost just can't get around the word king keeps showing up and like the idea of kingship. And what you see really here is a confrontation between Jesus on the cross and what we would consider to be, you know, the earthly powers. So Pilate, again, he's just been unjustly condemned. These people have all this political, worldly power, but yet Jesus is repeatedly called over and over again. He's called the king, and his kingship is really on display. And I think what John is trying to do in John chapter 19 is to reorient our ideas of what kingship means, of what power means. He's really reversing them and putting them on their head and saying, look, Pilate thinks that he is the one in control. By condemning Jesus, he thinks he's the one in control. He thinks because he's able to shout at people or to look down upon people from a place of quote unquote power, that, you know, he's the one that's closest to the king. But what we sort of see is just the inverse of that, that the one hanging on the cross, the one that has been condemned by the worldly powers, is actually himself the king. And it really causes us to pause and think about a few different things, like allegiances, for instance, to kings, but also just what we should expect from a person of power, from someone who is themselves a ruler or a king.
Yeah, it's interesting. I remember in the last podcast I was in, we were talking about our expectations, how Christ subverts our expectations. And it seems like maybe this is the best place in all of Scripture, maybe the history of the world, where the expectation is subverted, which is that you have the God of the universe, the most powerful thing that has ever been, right? The creator of all things, has power over all things, is allowing himself to be crucified. And it really makes you like question what it means to be a king or to have power. I think we just probably, I know me, like I natively think the person who has the most power is the person who can exert the most like force, I guess.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
Who's the most powerful kid in the neighborhood. It's the one that can bloody the most noses, yeah. Right?
And so you probably got your nose bloodied a lot then.
Mostly by my brother, who was younger but bigger than me.
Yeah.
But power exerted. But it's interesting that we see like in the biblical narrative, the inversion, I think, of authority and power, that in the biblical narrative, your authority and your status is not determined by the exertion of your power, but rather, I guess, the kind of laying down of your power in some way.
Yeah.
Where like the person who is in the most authority in the kingdom is actually the person who doesn't exert their power over the people under them, which we just normally call oppression, but rather uses their power or lays their power down to serve the people that's under them. And I think you see this a lot with the New Testament letters, which is where the people who have more power in certain like social contexts and relationships actually have a more demanding role, because that power has to actively not be used to oppress, but to be laid down and to serve. But it's just interesting. Interesting. It subverts my expectations about the use of power completely. And so it tells us something about God, that his power is not something that's exerted in judgment and wrath. That's like not his default, but rather his power is laid down in mercy and in love.
Yes, I think that idea of subverting our ideas is exactly right. And I think it's good to remind ourselves that it's not just our ideas, but even like the ideas of Jesus' disciples. Like when they're following him, like these are the guys that have been walking with him for years, that have been literally have given up their whole lives to be with him, to listen to him. Their expectation was for a Messiah. And this has been the Jewish expectation at the time of Jesus, been the Jewish expectation for thousands of years. And present day Jews, like they're still waiting for the Messiah. Mm. But what the expectation of the disciples were, again, these faithful Jews who truly believed Jesus was the Messiah, even they, like late in Jesus' ministry, are still like asking him, like, Jesus, when are you going to take Jerusalem by force? Mm-hmm. And when are you going to be, you know, enthroned as the rightful king of Jerusalem? Showing that they had this expectation of power and force, that's how Jesus, who was clearly the Christ, who was clearly the Messiah, that's how he was going to exert his power, is through just, you know, like they always, like it was always done in their minds, was by military force and taking it that way.
Yeah, maybe this is why I thought of that. Not even like during prep for this podcast, I randomly just ran across this quote again today for some reason. It's cliche, but I think it's actually really good. It's Napoleon Bonaparte's quote.
Well, this is really funny because you actually know this quote is in the student book, right?
Wait, are you kidding?
Yeah, no, it is. It's right there.
Hey, it's a great quote if you're a student.
Yeah, it's really great.
Yeah, well, I'll read it here because I brought it up anyway. It's from Napoleon, and I came across this again totally randomly on a random Twitter account, actually. Said, Alexander, Caesar, Charlemagne, and I founded empires, but on what did we rest the creations of our genius? Force. Jesus Christ founded his empire upon love, and at this hour, millions of people would die for him. It's a crazy quote, and I think he's right. Napoleon being one of the greatest military emperor conquerors
yeah.
in the last few hundred years. And he was able to very perceptively point out and notice the difference between his empire and the empire of Christ.
That's right. And one of the days that, you know, or we're asking you to sort of do some reflection before the group, in section two, we have you read Matthew 16, verses 24 through 26. And this is Jesus talking to his disciples. And it's really, it's a direct challenge to them that I think also is reflected on us. And we hope that you'll have some time of reflection. But basically what he says, look, anyone that would come after me, anyone that wants to follow me, says Jesus, let him deny himself and take up his cross and follow me. For whoever would save his life will lose it. But whoever loses his life for my sake we'll find it. And that's kind of what you were talking about earlier, CJ, is it really subverts our idea of what power is. And if it subverts our idea, or at least it should, of what it means to be Jesus followers, of what it means to worship God, of what it means to be in a relationship with God, is that really fundamental to this idea. If we want to be in a relationship, if we want to follow God to the cross, the God of the cross, then we have to ourselves take up our own cross and to die to ourselves. And this is sort of a daily challenge. And of course, there's all sorts of different ways that could go and different things that means. But we hope that that day, at least, you'll take some reflection, take some time to reflect on that.
So this also shows us, I think, right, the only God that's worthy of worship, right? I mean, there's, in one sense, if God was just this asserting, powerful being, right, then you worship him much like if you lived in the Soviet era, why you worship Stalin, because he could just send you to the gulag if you don't, right?
Yeah, yeah.
But I think that there's something else that's happening here, right? This is not the Stalin. This is not the Stalin God who's just waiting to send you to the gulag and assert his power. Instead, this is the God who's willing to lay his life down. So what does this mean for us in terms of worship?
Right. I think, you know, there always is this question, like, why should I worship God? Why should I worship Jesus? And I think that John 19 gives us a really good picture, a really good compelling reason to worship Jesus, is because this is the kind of God who loves us so much that he's willing to die for us. And, you know, one of the things I wanted to draw out in the group as well at some point is just that there just seems to be this sense, you know, if we read great books like maybe, you know, Tolkien's Lord of the Rings trilogy comes to mind. There are other great, you know, Narnia, things like this. There are just these great scenes in books and movies where there's these huge moments of self-sacrifice. And for whatever reason, those times of self-sacrifice just really resonate deeply with us, that there's something really beautiful about them. Mm-hmm. And I think the reason that is because this, you know, an event of self-sacrifice is at the core, the center of the universe. And there is something beautiful about this as well. As ugly as the crucifixion is, as evil as the crucifixion is, it is also paradoxically almost unbelievably good and unbelievably beautiful. And it's, you know, we're sort of invited into this. And as Jesus says, like, look, like you can reject this invitation. You can reject the invitation of the cross. But this is really the only way to life. And that's ultimately what the promise is that, because we know that this crucifixion doesn't just end in death, that it actually ends in resurrection and glorification, ascension. And we'll, you know, that's a little bit of a spoiler alert, I guess, that Jesus rises from the dead. But that is a part
Hopefully
of this. Not. Yeah, is that it is moving us from death into life, even though we paradoxically have to die first.
Great. Yeah. So Christ's kingship on display here makes demands of our allegiance, but also demonstrates that Christ is truly worthy of worship, uniquely worthy of worship, as opposed to the other gods that are on display. or that are tempting us to worship them, whether the real or you know, the gods that our culture worships, money, sex, self, etc. All right. Well, any final thoughts on John 19 you want to leave us with?
No, I think that's great. I think just reflecting on that idea of kingship and what does it look like to follow a king who goes to a cross is really the question of Christian discipleship and Christian formation. And so I hope in this week you'll really take that seriously.
Awesome. Well, thanks for tuning in with us on this week 8 podcast. We'll be back next time talking about the resurrection and what that means a little bit for campus. If you want to know more about the curriculum, you want to get some more resources, or just check out some more about the ministry CSF that produces them, you could head over to ukcsf.org, and then we'll see you next time.